Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools, VEA, teaching, learning, leading, online at veanea.org.
Welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This week, the Virginia General Assembly has reached crossover, the time that each of its two chambers finishes working on their own bills and begins to work on the bills passed in the other chamber. The General Assembly is considering dozens of criminal justice bills that would change the way Virginia handles the death penalty, all the way down to measures as small as making it a crime to disrupt a funeral. Joining us for this discussion of Virginia's crime and courts legislation are a pair of longtime experts in the field, Albemarle Sheriff Chip Harding and Charlottesville criminal defense lawyer Lloyd Snook. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Great to have you both on the program. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. Please give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. If you have a question for Albemarle Sheriff Chip Harding or Charlottesville defense lawyer Lloyd Snook. Chip, the General Assembly has passed repeal of Doug Wilder's landmark one-gun-a-month legislation. Each house has passed the bill, and it's going to the governor, and the governor intends to sign the bill, removing the one-gun-a-month restriction. What does this mean for Virginia, and do we really need the ability to buy more than one gun a month?
Well, when you talk about handguns, it's going to be interesting to see what effect this will have. You've been able for a long time now to be able to go to gun shows and just buy as many guns as you want. And in this case, people will be able to buy multiple handguns, and I'm assuming they'll still have the same record checks and so forth. It seemed like to me when I was in law enforcement and working with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms that there were a number of cases of straw purchases where people were able to acquire dozens of guns at a time, and they take them to New York City, and sometimes they'd stay here in Virginia, and it's better than gold on the streets when you're dealing with criminals, the value of a handgun. I'm all about the right to bear arms, but, I really don't understand the need to have repealed this.
Lloyd, where does this bill come from? Why is it being pushed, and what change does it mean for Virginia?
Well, this is one of a number of bills that has been on the legislative agenda of the National Rifle Association and others who are, really strong advocates of the Second Amendment, frankly, for its own sake. I suspect most of them have probably never needed to buy a second handgun in a month. Frankly, there are a whole lot of bills that were introduced this year that are part of the NRA agenda, and most of them have not gotten very far. A number of them have gotten specifically to the point where they said, well, we'll carry it over to talk about more next year. Some of them have been killed outright. This is one of the few that's actually gone ahead.
Chip Harding, you're a longtime police officer and expert in DNA use in Virginia. Is DNA changing the way Virginia looks at death penalty cases? We've only had, I think, two in the last 4 years in the state, which is a much lower number than we used to have. Is DNA changing the way we look at death penalty?
DNA should be changing the way not only Virginia but the whole country looks at death penalty cases. If one was to read Brandon Garrett, who's a professor at the University of Virginia, and Mr. Garrett had been part of the Innocence Project in his earlier years. He's written a book called Convicting the Innocent, and he studied the first 250 exonerations from DNA, and it blew my mind because I saw that when he went in and looked at researched, okay, DNA proved these people did not commit these crimes. Why were they convicted? I saw things and procedures and policies that I was part of in my career when I was doing investigative work that I did wrong that could have contributed towards convicting an innocent person. I don't think that ever happened, but it could have. And DNA should drastically open the minds, and I'm all about, and probably in the next couple of years we'll try to push more for an innocence commission in Virginia, much like North Carolina has. I think we need one. I'm involved in an innocence project case now. We're looking at a man that possibly was convicted wrongly in a neighboring county, and I've interviewed about 30 people in that, and some of the stuff that's coming out to me, you don't think it really happens in law enforcement, and it does. But DNA is doing so much to change the landscape. It's showing us a lot about our criminal justice system that we're not ready to admit sometimes.
Lloyd, you have handled death penalty cases. You've taken two of them to the U.S. Supreme Court. How do you see DNA changing the way the death penalty is used in Virginia, and how do you see the death penalty changing, if at all, in this General Assembly session?
Well, the first part of how DNA has changed the death penalty as a whole in Virginia, it has made everybody very, very much more conscious than they were before of making sure we've got it right. The most powerful force in favor of a life sentence, either at the plea bargaining stage, at the initial indictment stage, or at the trial stage, is, are we sure we've got the right person? And related to that is, are we sure about what actually happened? And so when we're not sure we've got the right person, for example, when DNA evidence isn't available, jurors are extremely reluctant to go for the death penalty, number one. And that's more so now than they used to be. It used to be in the old days, before people started realizing that it was possible to be scientific about the evidence, people would convict on the basis of some really, frankly, shockingly poor evidence. Now, when there is no DNA in a case, for whatever reason, and maybe it's because the circumstances of the crime just didn't allow for DNA. There was no opportunity to deposit blood or semen or anything like that. Jurors find themselves asking the question, how can we be sure? And so it's really changed the way not only capital murder cases get prosecuted, but the way all cases get prosecuted. You know, we're seeing right now in the Hughley case, for example, what I term the counter CSI effect. The CSI effect is this notion that jurors expect there to be DNA, or they expect some sort of magic chemical test that will, the scientists will go into the laboratory and poof, out will come this new test. And if you ever watch CSI, sometimes you sit there and say, where did that test come from? I never heard of that test before. And sometimes they frankly just kind of make it up. So the jurors kind of expect that level of scientific proof. And so prosecutors nowadays find themselves asking in every case, asking the detective, now there's no DNA evidence in this case. Why not? And they have to sort of prove why the jurors shouldn't be holding out for DNA. Anyway, that's sort of beside the point. The question of how it's going to come up, or how it is coming up right now in the General Assembly, the major bill out there that deals with capital murder this year is the change in the so-called trigger man rule. The trigger man rule is a rule that Virginia has long had that says
you can't fry somebody for a criminal offense unless he pulled the trigger.
Right. And that actually, there was a debate about this back in 1977 when the death penalty was reinstated. A.L. Philpott, who was the Speaker of the House, was very strongly against a broad death penalty statute. He wanted a narrow death penalty statute, number one, because he said it was the ultimate expression of government power over the individual, and he was uncomfortable with that. Number two, he wanted it to be reserved for the cases where we could be truly certain of what happened. So, for example, he didn't want to have the death penalty in the case of a murder and a commission of an attempted robbery or an attempted rape. He said, if you want to have a murder and the commission of an actual rape, a completed act or a completed robbery, that's fine, but attempt is kind of fuzzy. So here, the trigger man rule, what the bill that's out there would say is, you can impose the death penalty on somebody who didn't actually pull the trigger, provided that that person shared the same intent to kill as the person who did pull the trigger. What happens right now in federal court, for example, where this rule where this applies, is instead of right now where in state court we have a guilt or innocence phase and then we have a sentencing phase, in federal court there are actually three phases to the trial. There's the guilt or innocence, followed by a second jury decision where the jury has to decide whether in fact the guy intended to kill. And then the third question is whether he deserves to die. And so it's a little bit of more procedural, mucking around, frankly, that I'm not sure it accomplishes a whole lot, but it would kind of be necessary with this sort of statute.
Charlottesville lawyer Lloyd Snook and Albemarle Sheriff Chip Harding are my guests on Assembly Conversations. Give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. If you have a question for Lloyd Snook and or Chip Harding. Let's look at the Castle Doctrine. That is another major change in criminal defense law that comes up in this session of the General Assembly, extending the ability of a homeowner to kill someone who is invading his property, is the way I understand it. How does this legislation changing this year?
Well, first of all, this is another example of the NRA's agenda moving forward. Interestingly, the expression of the so-called castle doctrine, and it gets the name because one's home is one's castle, and there's a great quotation from William Pitt, I can't remember whether the elder or the younger, where he says, you know, the wind may blow, the rain may, but the King of England cannot cross the threshold of the lowliest tenement in London. And so this notion that the castle, that the home is the castle, and you get to defend the castle with potentially deadly force, has actually been the law since 1604. We don't need this law to say what the NRA wants to say.
So it's putting on the books exactly what is practiced in Virginia courts?
Basically, yes. And I always ask in a case like this, you know, what problem is this statute solving? Can anybody point me to a case where a homeowner got sued by the family of somebody who was shot while committing a breaking and entering, where that lawsuit went forward, where there were damages recovered? I can't find anybody who can tell me of such a case. So on one level, this is a statute that will not change anything. And so you sort of say, well, who cares? On the other hand, if it doesn't change anything, why bother?
Chip, have you seen any of this law applied around Charlottesville?
No, but I would say I tend to agree with Lloyd. The listeners aren't confused. It's not just as I understand it, it's not just shoot somebody because they broke in your home, but having committed an overt act toward an occupant or another person in the dwelling that makes you reasonably believe that it puts you in imminent danger. Because in law enforcement, we're trained not to shoot unless we feel like our life or someone else's life is at jeopardy.
So if someone breaks into a home and is just sitting there playing tiddlywinks,
you can't shoot
them.
No.
But if someone does something threatening to you, you can shoot them.
And I'm going to. And I was on one of the first drug by bus we did. The officer I was working with shot and killed a man. And he did so because he ordered the two occupants in the front seat to put their hands on the dash. And they did so, looked him in the eye, and the guy in the passenger seat suddenly went down into the floorboard. And when he started up, the guy I was working with shot him in the neck and killed him. I ran around the car and looked, and there happened to be a firearm. He never saw the firearm. But if he had waited another second or two,
he could have been shot.
He'd have been shot. Mm-hmm. No question in my mind. Same way, if someone was to break into my home, if it looks like they have a firearm and they're getting ready to point it at me, you've got to shoot or be ready to take the be on the receiving end. Same way, if they have a knife, if you order them to stop and they get within so many feet, you only have a split second in order to defend yourself. And it's a tough call, and I don't think any law is going to ever be able to tell you when to shoot and not shoot somebody. There have been times in my career when I could have shot people, but something told me not to, and it turned out I didn't need to. I'm so thankful for that.
And there have been cases cited. It's one of the sort of urban legend kinds of cases where you always hear about the guy who, in trying to break into a store, crashes through the skylight and ends up suing the store owners for having a defective skylight because it wouldn't support. You know, nobody can find where that case actually came up. But if you sort of follow through the literature of tort reform, and you'll always find references to that sort of thing.
Well, technology is changing the way we look at criminal law. One of the bills that's passing is a laser pointing at an aircraft, which is obviously a dangerous situation for pilots and those on the plane. That unanimously passed the House Appropriations Committees. It's one of those bills that you basically have to take a two-pronged test to get bills passed if they're criminal justice bills and they carry a price tag, because it has to go to the money committees to have the price tag looked at to see if it can be accommodated in the budget. And they decided that apparently there weren't enough laser tag bills to bust the budget, so that they unanimously approved making this a crime. Can you point to any other technology changes in legislation this year that you think are updating the code because of, texting while driving, of course, is one. They're trying to make that a primary offense.
As far as actual new crimes, I can't think of any.
There is one that Delegate Joe May had passed. It's passed the House already, that basically forbids a citizen and anyone other than police from planting a device to track someone in their car. That is now going to be a crime in Virginia.
Does it have any, I haven't seen the statute, any exemptions to it at all?
There are a few exemptions, but basically
just
says,
law
enforcement, basically, you can't put a GPS to track your wife or your, without that person's knowledge or consent.
Or a search warrant.
Or a search warrant,
yeah. Because, the Supreme Court ruled on that recently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I always wondered for years, we did it in drug cases when we were trying to follow drug dealers around, and it always seemed odd to me that we could sneak around and put something up on the guy's vehicle and we didn't need to have a search warrant in order to do it.
Although if you look carefully at that decision, it's not clear whether whether there would have been five votes to say you can't do that if it was just going to be a short-term thing, if you put it on for a couple days. The issue there was, and in fact, a number of the justices specifically limited their decision to, this thing was on there for more than a month. And so anyway, it'll be interesting to see how that all shakes out. But, there are some detectives, for example, who will use this to track the comings and goings of errant spouses. There are also some parents who use it to track the comings and goings of their kids.
I wonder if there's a kid exception. I have not read the legislation. I've only seen it summarized. There are other pieces of legislation that I think we should talk about, one of which that failed would have greatly increased the threshold for grand larceny. State Senator Bryce Reeves of Spotsylvania to Albemarle had a bill in to increase from the $200 threshold to make something a grand larceny. He would have taken that up to $750, which, probably is in line with where the $200 was several years ago. But that bill was killed. There was no need seen to increase the threshold. So we're staying at $200 for grand larceny.
Well, one of the things, first of all, the last time it went up from $100 to $200 in 1980. The consumer price index has basically tripled since then. So $200 would effectively be $600 or a little bit more. So the ratio is about right. But this kind of, one of the things that happens is that virtually every Commonwealth's attorney's office ends up coming up with some sort of a policy for saying when it is that somebody who steals a $200 leather jacket isn't going to get prosecuted as a felony, because most prosecutors say, we don't need to be creating more felons. That's not good policy. If you make the laws too harsh, then one of the things you end up doing is you end up forcing more people to have trials and more people to fight harder and so on. And so if we were to increase the limit from $200 to $750 or $500, which is the other proposal, there is less sort of winking at the law. Nowadays, if somebody has a $300 leather jacket that they've stolen, they go into court and the prosecutor just agrees to strike the language of having a value of $200 or more, and then it goes forward as a misdemeanor petty larceny. So this bill would have done effectively what's happening most of the time anyway, but that degree of realism apparently was something that the retail merchants were very unhappy about.
Charlottesville defense lawyer Lloyd Snook and Albemarle Sheriff Chip Harding are my guests on Assembly Conversations. Give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. If you have a question for either gentleman, Chip, what do you think this 2012 session of the legislature is going to be remembered for in the area that we're talking about?
I have no idea, Bob.
I mean, right now, the biggest bill that the two that have gained the most notoriety are the repeal of the one-gun-a-month restriction that Virginia had on the books since Governor Wilder, and the change to put into writing the Castle Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it has not been a session that's been greatly marked by fights over criminal justice legislation.
Yeah, I mean, from what I've seen so far, I don't think it's going to have any great impact. I mean, there have been years we've seen tremendous impact. I don't think you're going to really see that much, any tremendous change in the way that business is conducted.
Well, it's snuck, and yet we have bills that are going to add millions of dollars to the state budget to make tough on crime laws tougher on criminals. One of them is sponsored by a local delegate from the Albemarle area, Rob Bell, who is running for attorney general in the next year's election. And Delegate Bell has a bill to have a mandatory, 5-year sentence for a second conviction for drug trafficking if you have a violent felony.
Yeah, every time we end up with a mandatory sentence, my initial reaction is to say, here's somebody who is just trying to run for higher office saying I'm tough on crime. What happens when there's a mandatory sentence? Two things. The first is that you effectively give more control to the prosecutor and less control to the judge. And so if the prosecutor says, I'm going to charge this as a second offense, that ends up changing hugely the balance of power in how this goes forward. And in many cases, the prosecutor will go ahead and say, well, I'll reduce it to a first offense if you plead guilty and agree to a 3-year sentence. And the guy sits there and says, okay, I can do 3 years better than I can do 5 years. Fine, I'll plead guilty. I don't want to run the risk of getting five or more. And so there are a lot of mandatory sentences. Or another example, there's a bill here that passed 100-0 in the House of Delegates, and a companion version passed 40-0 in the Senate. And one of the provisions of the bill calls for a mandatory life sentence for anyone who commits rape or sodomy or object penetration of someone under the age of 13. Now, I think we can all agree that somebody who does that is a bad person and needs to be severely punished. Whether that person needs to have a mandatory life sentence, I can tell you right now that what's going to happen more than anything else is that it's going to be used to coerce guilty pleas. People are going to sit there, and a prosecutor will sit there and say, if you don't plead guilty to this lesser offense and you agree to take a 30-year sentence, you'll get a mandatory life and that kind of thing. And does anybody really think that Virginia judges aren't going to be pretty harsh on somebody like that anyway?
Let's go to our callers. Our next caller is Molly in Richmond. Molly, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Lloyd Snook and Chip Harding.
Good evening, gentlemen. I've got a question related to the legislation regarding GPS devices. I'm just wondering if the proposed legislation applies to car dealers. I know that some automotive and motorcycle dealers use GPS devices on people who carry notes.
That's interesting. It's Delegate May's bill. I have not read the entire text, so I don't know what the exemptions are. Lloyd, have you looked at that?
I haven't seen the bill. You gave us a list of ones to study up on, and that wasn't one of them.
It's a good question, because I understand that some of them have GPS systems on there and also shutdown systems that, if you haven't paid, if they're looking for you to repo that car, that they can locate it and shut it down.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and then there's also questions about what does this mean for OnStar?
Well, there is an exemption for OnStar.
Is there?
Yes,
okay.
That was written into the law. Thank you, Molly. Thanks for your question. We'll see if we can't come
up
with an answer.
Sorry we didn't know the answer.
in the next 30 minutes or so. Thank you. Our next caller is Bill from Independence. Bill, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Lloyd Snook and Chip Harding. Hi, Bill.
Not Bill, Beryl.
Well, it says Bill on my record, but you sound more like a bell, so we'll say Bell. Welcome
Beryl.
To
Beryl.
Beryl, welcome to Assembly Conversations.
Yes, I had a question. Under what circumstances the sheriff's department can confiscate all your guns?
Whoa. Well, we have a sheriff sitting here. Sheriff,
I mean, there are of various circumstances. If you're a convicted felon in possession of a firearm, we can confiscate it. If you use a firearm in commission of a felon, we can confiscate them.
They had a search warrant to search my house, and when they found all my guns, they took them along with everything else.
And what were they? What was the reason for the search warrant?
Drug paraphernalia.
Okay. Well, they might be loosely bringing that in, saying that they may be trying to put together a case saying that you were distributing drugs, and you're not allowed to have the firearms and do that. So, I guess you got to wait and see how that plays out. I can't say whether they were right or wrong in that particular situation.
Do I gather that the case hasn't gone to court yet?
Right.
Yeah. So what'll probably happen is if they can't make the case, as Sheriff Harding is suggesting, that the guns and drugs and whatever all are related, they're going to have to give the guns back. And if somebody gets convicted of a felony, they'd have to be given back to somebody who wasn't a felon, but they would come back unless they're actually evidence of the crime.
Thank you, Beryl. Thank you very much for your call and your question. My guests this evening are Lloyd Snook, a criminal defense lawyer from Charlottesville, and Chip Harding, the sheriff of Albemarle County, twice elected. And we will be taking your calls and questions at 1-866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. When inmates leave prison, the biggest problem they have is finding no work, the inability to find work. Some sociologists are saying that this pushes them back into a life of crime. Is Virginia doing anything, Sheriff Harding, to start to address that problem in a more realistic way now?
Well, locally, our jail has a reentry program going. It's kind of being pushed statewide, where you're given more job skills, interview skills, and it's a requirement everybody going through our local jail. And it's on any average day, we have 540 inmates over there. I have been pushing for 2 years, and a number of judges have now signed off. We've got some more we're hoping that will, to increase the inmate workforce, which will allow inmates to go out and perform work for government or 501Cs. And they won't be paid anything, but they'll be credited minimum wage towards their court costs and fines. And what I find is, like, I have an inmate that's working over at our office now. He washes cars and does a great job, cleans up and landscapes and so forth. Most of these young men I interview, when they come through in workforce, have $3,000 to $5,000 in fines, and they cannot get their driver's license back. So we send them out. It's hard enough to get a job if you're convicted felon or misdemeanor to get a job, much less have a hole already dug for you with a $4,000 or $5,000 fine and no ability to drive a vehicle.
Gentlemen, we've got to take a break. You are listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We'll be right back after this short break.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Assembly Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.